This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 3rd of June 2012 on Monocle 24. It's Sunday, 3rd of June 2012, and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 152, with me, Robert Bound, and Steve Bloomfield. On today's show, we'll be sitting down with Ken Siegel, one-time colleague of Steve Jobs, who witnessed the near-death experience, recovery, and growth of Apple as its creative director.
Today, as I'm sure you know, marks the birthday of Cuba's current leader, Raul Castro, but we'll be paying a bit more attention to his brother Fidel as we speak to a former CIA analyst who's written a book that reveals new information on what Castro was up to during his years in power.
Plus, there's Brazilian television culture, Saturday Night Live style, and we're soothed by the soulful tones of Belarus in a live Midori House session.
That's all right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
What a week, what a week, what a lovely week, Steve.
It has been a lovely week, hasn't it?
I've hurt my shoulder from typing.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Maybe not.
Not just from sort of lying at an awkward angle in the sun.
That's fine. No, but it has been. It's been a great week. It's been a week where we, as we were discussing before we turned the mics on, whether or not you could get away with shorts in the office. We've seen a lot of shorts in the office.
There's been a lot of shorts in the office. I haven't worn shorts.
I haven't worn shorts.
I just think it's, I don't know.
I'm 34.
You think you reach a certain age when you shouldn't wear shorts anymore
in the office? I should wear shorts, but not in the office.
I wear shorts on holiday. When I was in Sicily last week, I wore shorts.
Yeah. What about shorts and a jacket? I've seen that sported.
Really?
Yeah. Like, as if you're kind of like, you know when tennis players win Wimbledon and then they put a jacket on?
Yes.
They have to put a jacket on to be smart.
I'm like a little bit smart.
Yeah, but it says to me is sort of school trip.
Or 7-year-old at a prep school.
Precisely.
Yeah.
It does seem a bit like that. I think that if you're going to wear shorts with a jacket, then you should probably wear socks up to the knee, like at a golf course, like at an old-fashioned golf course.
And shoes.
And shoes, and possibly a cap.
And then you need one of those sort of boxy satchels that go around your neck.
Yeah, like a sort of leather filing cabinet with a strap on.
Yes, exactly.
strap on.
That's what I'm going to be wearing on Monday if the sun is still out.
I was going to say, I hope it's rainy. so here we are. We've just put the July August summer bonanza quality of life issue to bed. We sort of talked when I presented the show last week with Jonathan. He was a bit sort of premature and said, "Oh, we've just finished the issue." And I think that's because he is in Marrakesh
yes,
this week.
Yes, exactly.
And so as far as he was concerned, he'd done it.
It was done.
But actually, I think we've still been sort of sweating away until the recesses of Friday. Exactly.
We were. But it's done. It's good. Well, no, it's not just good. It's great.
It is really good, actually.
And it's got
a cover.
It has. Yeah, I really like the cover.
It's good.
And it's got a winning sissy, which we can't reveal yet.
No.
Do you know when we're going to reveal the winning sissy?
I don't know. When you find a drum to do a drum roll with?
No. We're going to reveal it at the Monocle Country Fair.
Oh, wait,
On the evening of the first night, the Monocle Country Fair, as I'm sure everyone knows by now,
listeners know about that.
Is on Saturday the 16th and Sunday the 17th of June, right here in Midori House, well, in the courtyard. You know the petting zoo's been ordered.
Yeah, I know that. I've heard a publisher, in fact, on the phone.
More goats!
I've heard her on the phone sort of saying, so what have you, goats, yeah, and what sort of dogs are you allowed? Lambs aren't in season. Okay. They are from the butchers, but not as living creatures, unfortunately, to pet.
We've got goats, pigs.
It's going to be amazing.
4 rabbits, apparently.
So this presumably, when we announced the most livable city in the world, as judged by Monocle editors, at the country fair, we'd be spoiling the plot if we were to admit that it was Barnstable. Or Taunton, or somewhere where you feel like a country fair would be quite at home.
Yes.
Exeter.
That wouldn't quite be the most livable city, would it? But
Exeter's got a cathedral.
Yeah, Exeter does have a cathedral. Yeah,
and
it's
an
a
airport.
City. Yeah. Well, maybe it is Exeter. Who knows? Well, actually, I do know, and it's not.
We'll be getting some letters, won't we?
What, from Exeterites?
Yeah, exactly. But without further ado, we shall be back in a minute talking to Ken Siegel, who is one of the head honchos at Apple. Apple Our first guest is responsible for coming up with the iconic name iMac and for inserting lowercase i's before what used to be common words like pad or phone. Ken Segal, who played a key role in Apple's resurrection in the 1990s, is the author of a new book, Insanely Simple, The Obsession That Drives Apple's Success. And he joins us now in the studio. Welcome to The Weekly, Ken.
Well, hello. Thanks for inviting me over.
Well, thanks for coming in. This sounds like Insanely Simple. We've often heard things, similar terms to describe Apple, and it's maybe the success isn't insanely simple, but the kind of it has a reputation for simplicity. Is this really well earned? Because underneath all that simplicity, there's a lot of complication for me.
That's very true, and this is actually one of the reasons I wrote the book. That I think people see the products and they are indeed simple, but it takes a lot of work to achieve that simplicity. But even more important than that, Apple doesn't just have this magical ability to produce a product at the end of the process that's simple. They really believe in simplicity from top to bottom. So it's all throughout the organization, the way they cut out committees and they streamline processes and their advertising is simple. Pretty much everything Steve Jobs ruled on, he did with this simplicity in mind. And that's why I wrote the book. And by the way, also, inspiration to write the book was that I then went to work with other companies that didn't believe in simplicity. Right. And the difference between the worlds is just astounding.
Yeah, it'd be nice to get a little window into those two worlds. You know, because as I say, Apple, I didn't know whether it was a simple place to work as it was to, you know, as the sheen on its machines had. What was the difference between that and then where you went on to?
Well, I went on to work with companies like Dell and Intel. Mm-hmm. And as I say, part of my inspiration to write the book really came from those experiences because you get so frustrated, my colleagues and I, wishing that things would be simpler, and why do they make us go through all these things that would take more time and cost more money? Whereas in the world of Apple, they would just go from point A to point B and just be there. And I guess it was because they had a lot of confidence in themselves. They didn't try to prove things with research. I'm sure a lot of companies look at that and say that's a foolish way to do business. But the way I argue it, look at the results. Apple is the most valuable company on the face of the earth and the most profitable. Certainly, they do things right and they don't do all those complicated things.
One thing, though, we do know about Apple is that the boss, Steve Jobs, was not necessarily the easiest person to work with. Perhaps you could give us a little bit of an insight into that. But also, what I'm intrigued to know is, do you think that you actually need a boss like that with that sort of instinct to make a company work in a, as you say, simple way?
Right. Well, that's a very, very good question. And I know a lot of people do debate, do you have to be like Steve was to get things done? He was an interesting mix of personality traits, the likes of which we'll obviously never see again. So it's a little hard to say that you can that you could even be like him if you tried, because he had that genius, he had the impatience, he had the passion. My sense was that he had a nice side, a human side, a funny side, charismatic, all of that. That doesn't get quite as much press as the mean side. So I would just say he was a complicated person. And when he did get rough, and he certainly did, I was on the receiving end a couple of times, it was usually for a reason. He had this passion for a certain product. If it was iMac, for instance, he had just come back to Apple after all those years of exile, and the whole world was watching. He wanted every detail to be right about that machine. And when something wasn't, he would get, shall we say, passionate in the way he would dismiss someone or try to overcome some kind of obstacle.
I think I think that passionate used in that that way is spelled with a capital P, like simplicity is spelled with a capital S.
Yes,
right. I got that feeling. I wanted to know about this in the prelim to you, Ken. We talked about the prefix I, the lowercase I. What was the meeting like, or what was the 3 a.m. wake up in the middle of the night, scribble it down on a piece of paper? What was the eureka moment with that?
Well, it wasn't exactly a eureka moment, but it's an interesting story, because when Steve asked us to come up with a name for iMac, he had a name in his head, which was a sort of a laughable one by today's standards.
Was it ZX325 subsection? The company wouldn't be what it is if it didn't have the exact.
Yeah. It was Commodore 65.
Right. Well, it was almost as bad. It was Mac Man. And he was convinced that there was something magical about that, and it had a little bit of a Sony sound to it. Mm. And back in those days, Sony was a big, respectable company, and Steve thought there might be some value in having a little rub-off, as he called it. But he said, you got 2 weeks to come up with something better, and iMac was one of the first names I came up with because it's somewhat obvious. It was mostly about the internet, and we wanted people to know that it was a Mac. So iMac was one of my first names, and then we filled walls with ideas and went in to show him five names at first meeting, and he hated all five of them, including iMac. And then he said, now you got a week. So then we worked some more, came back in another week, showed him probably three more names, and then I pull iMac out of the bag again, trying for that desperate play, get him to buy it at the last minute. And he said, well, I don't hate it this week, but I don't like it either. So now you got 2 days. And then really, there's not much of an ending other than the fact that the next day I was talking to someone inside Apple, and they said, hey, guess what? Steve's running around. He had the name silk screened on one of the models. He's sharing it with people, getting opinions, and wow. So I never had another conversation with him about it, but he decided to go with it.
And in that situation, is it a case that when you try and present it again, you put it in a different font? Maybe, hey, we'll try it in Helvetica this time. Or right. Or you tell a different story behind it about why iMac sums up everything you want to do?
Right. Well, you know, there are varying theories on how you should present to clients like that. And one school of thought is that you should never bring back something that was rejected. You're just asking for trouble. And with a guy like Steve, who could be volatile, there's a reasonable argument for that. But another school of thought is that as long as you show new stuff, you're perfectly entitled to say, but we still kind of like this old one. So that's what we did. And he was fine with it. And ultimately, he was very fine with it.
And I want to bring it back to the idea of Mac Man. When you have a boss who is, as you describe, volatile or passionate, who comes up with something like Mac Man, which you think, oh my God, that's awful. How do
Mac Man wears his pants outside his trousers. He's a superhero of the old school.
A Scottish superhero. How do you sort of say that to him?
Well, that's exactly what our reaction was. We were somewhat appalled individually, but we're sitting at a table and we're looking at each other and the eyeballs and everything.
No one wants to be the first person to say.
Well, we didn't say, you know, it's horrible. We just said, well, we hear you, but we think we can do better. You know, until you have something to show him is better, you can't really say it's a terrible name. So we absorbed it, went back and came up with a battle plan. And like I say, we were pretty sure we had the winner. And we were a little bit on the depressed side when Steve looked at our winner and said, no, thanks.
And how does that work? Having been one of the architects of the future of, you know, as you say, such a famous company with such iconic products and now the most valuable company in the world. Where do you see things going next? I mean, it's funny, Mac Man was, you hope for a bit of rub off from Walkman or Discman from Sony.
Right.
How do you not become the next Sony and for people to think, you know, an iPod is an archaic piece of kit in 10 years' time like they do with a Walkman? That's a tough one.
Well, that certainly is Apple's challenge. We've seen it already. The bigger and more successful they get, there are more and more people determined to drag it down and criticize. And every little opening, iPhone 4, antenna problem, end of the world, or something like that, they'll have to deal with that more and more as they get bigger. And people have that perception they're trying to control the world. And, you know, they're taking our freedom away from us. And you see that stuff out there now. I think there's part of a natural cycle to a life cycle to a company like that, and hopefully they can be good guys well into the future before people turn on them like they did with Microsoft. It's hard for Microsoft to get a lot of love anymore.
I want to ask you about that. Actually, you refer to Apple as the good guys, and it certainly for a very long time had that reputation. And Microsoft has had not such a good reputation, Bill Gates in particular, despite the fact that Bill Gates has given billions of dollars of his own money to charity and Steve Jobs gave very little. And also Apple's had enormous problems with stories about how the products are actually made in China and Foxconn. How do you, when you look at those issues, how do you sort of justify them to yourselves? Are you comfortable with how Apple makes its products?
It's an interesting thing to think about because you're right. I think people who love Apple like to think of them as the really good company that has the customer experience in mind. And then when you start hearing stories that people are are the laborers who are laboring under such not great conditions. Is that really right? I think what's been interesting to me is that Tim Cook, what he has done versus what Steve Jobs might have done, there's always speculation. As we all know, all these other companies use the same Chinese plants. It's not just Apple. So you could always, some people would rationalize it that way, but obviously it's still not good. And I think it's been interesting that Tim Cook went over there and had his tour, and he had this independent company study the conditions and deliver a report that was actually very critical of Apple, and that they've actually decided to do something about it, which will probably require them to raise the price of their products, because that is why they were so they were able to maintain the prices, obviously, that the labor is so cheap. So I don't think any of those other companies, Dell, HP, or all the rest of them, would ever have done anything because they didn't have the incentive. So in a weird way, and I'm not trying to rationalize Apple's behavior, but I think kind of only Apple was in the position to affect a change, and then these other guys are going to have to raise their prices along with Apple. And
but you're not really, I mean, from what you're saying and also the way you're sitting as well, you're not comfortable with it, are you?
No, I mean, I think it's a bad situation that so many affluent people in the world should benefit by people laboring under unfair conditions, even though those conditions may be normal in the country they're living in. From all we know, it's a common condition in Chinese factories. And people talked about the suicide rate in Foxconn, which actually are, as I understand it, lower than the general population of China. But when you take it individually, it seems like a bad thing. Clearly, China has some issues, and Apple can't be responsible for all of those issues. So it's a very touchy situation that Apple is in, that Apple finds itself in. But I think they have this opportunity to lead in that regard and let the Dells and HPs of the world sort of follow them. For Apple should seize the opportunity, I guess that's what I'm saying, to lead the way to become a champion of those workers, as opposed to, well, everybody does it, so we're going to keep doing it.
All right, well, let's end where we began with the title of the book, Ken, as well. Insanely Simple. Is it only insanely simple compared to everybody else? Is that where the insanely comes from?
Well, the insanely actually comes from Steve's first unveiling of the Macintosh in 1984 when he said it's insanely great. And those words have sort of resonated in...
It doesn't even work. It's insanely great.
In the Apple culture, the insanely word has been repeated for years and years. So I thought I'd bring it back because it reeks of Apple. And the simplicity thing is so important to them. I really do think it pervades the company, and it is different. There's a lot more common sense. I don't even think it's attached to Steve's major revolutions as much as it is his day-to-day operations, the way he'd go from meeting to meeting and make these decisions that you'd be thankful that he was in the room. And these other companies, you would always wish that somebody would act like Steve and throw that person out of the room and make everyone do this or that. Apple operated with that kind of clarity from day to day, and it was it was something I missed very much when I went to work with these other companies. And I understood that was why they ended up with more mediocre products than Apple.
Ken Siegel, we're going to have to leave it there. One thing before you do go, I just want to point out, despite the fact that you've started a book with a title which has an I at the start.
I know.
It's a capital I.
It is.
Why didn't you go for a little I?
You know, I hate to even admit this, but I didn't realize that until someone pointed it out to me only fairly recently.
Okay, well, never mind.
It might have looked like a typo, mightn't it? And then, until you read to the bottom and then you got the joke.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Second edition, think about it.
Well, definitely.
Ken Siegel, thank you very much. The book is Insanely Simple, The Obsession That Drives Apple's Success. You're listening to Michael Weekly. When we come back, Rob's going to play some music, aren't you, Rob?
I'm going to sing, actually, myself. We're not going to play any records this week.
Really?
No.
Okay, you're listening to Michael Weekly.
During next week's Quality of Life Week, join me, Andrew Tuck, as I take over the second half of Midori House with a mayoral special, looking at the people running cities from Kabul to Geneva, Atlanta to Tel Aviv. Meet the people with City Hall challenges as diverse as luring in diplomats to getting water to come out of taps, wooing big business to tapping into people's downtime pleasures. So put on your finest chains and robes for a meeting with the mayor all next week on The Briefing here on Monocle 24.
And you have successfully tuned into the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bowen, and Steve Bloomfield. Ken Siegel was interesting, wasn't he?
He was. I liked him a lot.
It's good to put him on the spot a bit.
Yeah.
It's not all, you know, happy and green in the garden, in the apple, in the orchard.
In the apple orchard.
That was, yes.
No, it's not. And it's interesting sort of, you know, looking at that sort of difference between a reputation of a company and actually the sort of the seedier side of it, which... you're seeing now more, now that Steve Jobs has died, there's actually a sort of a lot more being talked about the problems with Apple than I think you saw before, because he was seen by many in the press as sort of a bit of a deity.
I know, and I'm always surprised actually that people are so, you know, there's such blanket coverage of sort of, you know, whether or not he should be canonized, rather than actually like, well, you know, it's fine. He was obviously a genius, but you know, no one. It's like that thing, you know. Everyone with a great reputation probably has stood on a few feet in order to get there.
Exactly, and as Ken was saying, he's volatile and he was passionate. Passionate with a capital P.
Passionate with a capital P. I, Mac with a capital I. It's quite a cool thing. It must be one of those weird things when you're walking through every airport in the world and into every electronic store, and you sit on a bus and every single person on the top deck of a bus has an I something, whether it's
and you think,
phone
that.
Or AirPod, or it's like, yeah, that was my idea. It's kind of, it must be quite a...
And just think, it could have been Mac Man, Pod Man.
I know, that wouldn't be
Pad Man. Pad Man. That's not good, is it?
I don't like the sound of that much. No. Should we have some music, Steve?
Yes, let's. What have you got? You're not actually going to sing, are you?
I'm not going to sing. Okay, I'm going to leave it up to Becky Jones, who performs under the name Saint Saviour, and she's sung with lots of other people. She sung with Groove Armada and went on tour with them,
oh, yeah.
And she's lent her vocals to all sorts of things. She's a gun for hire, or her pipes are for hire. And she's recorded her first album. She's sort of mixed. She's written, recorded, produced, mixed every single thing, promoted, and had her album paid for through one of these crowdsourcing websites. Do you know what the album's called?
Is it called...
I don't know what it's called, because it's so new. It's coming out in the summer. I wanted to play a track off it. The track doesn't have a name, which is ridiculous.
The track doesn't
so
have
we
a can, name.
Well, we'll keep our audience's breath baited.
Is this the song?
Well, this is track 7 from the upcoming Saint Saviour album. I spoke to the PR and they said it doesn't have a name. Huh. So here we go. But it is really lovely. You might hear echoes of Kate Bush in it. You might hear many other things. But this is Saint Saviour.
I like
nice,
that.
Yeah.
That was a bit Kate Bushy.
She's very good, isn't she? A little bit of Sinead O'Connor in there, maybe. All sorts of things.
And I think some of the lazier Capital FM DJs, if they play it, will say, oh, it's a bit like Adele.
Yes. Well, yes, exactly. Don't tune into those, guys.
No,
Foxy.
Don't.
I've got Foxy on.
Have you?
Yeah, no, not really.
That's Magic FM.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah.
It's defected.
Yeah.
No one else knows what we're talking about.
These are the joys
of
London commercial radio. you're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're going to be talking about Cuba. A new book on Cuba's intelligence battles with the CIA sheds new light on Fidel Castro's attempts to assassinate foreign leaders and even infiltrate the CIA itself. The author of Castro's Secrets, Brian Littell, a veteran CIA analyst, joins us on the line now from Washington, D.C. Brian, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Well, thank you. Good to be with you.
Now, in this new book, you're making some quite serious claims here that haven't been made before, that Fidel Castro was really a bit of a spy master and kind of had the U.S. on the run for a number of years.
That's correct. For about 25 years, from the beginning of his government in 1959 until 1987, Fidel was running circles around American intelligence. They underestimated his abilities, and they underestimated the skills of Cuban intelligence. The story really was not known to the CIA until a defector came out from Cuban intelligence in the summer of 1987. And this man revealed a host of double agents that the Cubans had been running against the CIA and penetration agents in the government in Washington and American professors who had been recruited by Cuban intelligence to do Fidel's work. It was quite a story that this defector brought.
And, you know, obviously we've heard numerous stories over the years about attempts that CIA have made against Castro's life, against his government and regime. But less going the other way. How much of what Castro's agents were doing was defense and how much was offense?
Good intelligence, of course, is both. It's both offensive and defensive. And at times, distinguishing between the two is not really possible. But they were very good at both. The Cubans are still very good, especially at counterintelligence, and you could say that's mainly defensive. They're very good at penetration and mole operations, and you could say that's mostly offensive. They run double agents and have for years with exquisite skill. It's really quite remarkable. They learned a lot from the KGB. In later years, they learned a lot from the German Stasi. But I tell you, the main reason I think that they're so good is because for years, 48 years, Fidel Castro himself personally reigned as the supreme spymaster. And it's in his blood, it's in his genes. Conspiracy and manipulation and black operations, all of that is just a key part of Fidel Castro, always has been.
Hi, Brian. This is Rob in the studio with Steve. I wondered about that. That's not the kind of reputation that Castro obviously has. That's one of the big selling points, I guess, of your book. How easy is it for a politician, a leader like Castro, to mix all his histrionics and hyperbole in his famously long speeches with this kind of undercover thing? I mean, were you surprised to learn about it through the sources of your book?
I was surprised, even though I had written an earlier book, it's called After Fidel, that really probed deeply into Fidel's psychology and his leadership style. But I was surprised, as defectors from Cuban intelligence all told me the same thing. Fidel really himself personally ran just about every operation, covert clandestine operation against the Americans. He was deeply involved in all of the double agent operations. When there was a really good spy that they had in Washington or Miami, it was Fidel who personally orchestrated all of that. So he was for years Cuba's supreme spymaster.
And you said that the Cuban spies were learning from the Stasi and the KGB. Obviously, there's a clear link between those three countries. But how did that work? I mean, was it literally sort of people going over and saying, this is how you do this, this is how you do this? I mean, learning the finer points of spying presumably are an art form that take years to perfect.
Well, you know, that was one of the things the CIA thought, that it would take the Cubans years and years to get up to speed. You know, we Americans learned espionage tradecraft from you all, from Britain, mm-hmm. from your special services beginning during World War II and then afterwards. And I think we picked it up pretty quickly, and the Cubans picked it up really quickly from KGB instructors in the very early years. But also because Fidel Castro himself was so good at it, he almost intuitively understood how to conduct these kinds of operations. And you know, basic intelligence, foreign intelligence tradecraft is pretty universal. There are variations, of course. Some do it better than others. Some develop subspecialties and so on. But the basics are pretty universal and have been for generations.
Brian, let's talk about the assassination of John F. Kennedy, because you claim in the book that. Or as you put it, Castro and his intelligence officers were complicit in Kennedy's death, although it wasn't, it'd be going too far to say they organised the actual assassination. What are you basing these claims on?
Well, there are defectors and other sources. Now, my principal source is a man named Florentino Aspillaga. He's the defector I mentioned earlier. He defected in Vienna in June of 1987, and he's the one who came to Washington and began spilling the beans on how the Cubans had been beating the Americans at their own game for so long. It was Aspiaga who told me. I conducted about 15 hours of recorded interviews with him. Many years later, it wasn't. It was 20 years after he defected when I interviewed him. But he told me that on the morning of November 22, 1963, that's the day Kennedy was shot, he, Aspiaga, received orders at his listening post. He did electronic eavesdropping. And he received orders that morning to cease all of his operations against the CIA and instead to listen to Texas. Point all of your antennas, all of your listening equipment toward Texas. We want to know of anything unusual that happens in Texas. And it was 3 hours later that Kennedy was killed. Aspiaga told me they knew, Fidel knew, that there was going, shots were going to be fired at Kennedy.
When you're talking to defectors like this, how hard is it to work out what they're telling is true and what they're telling is some sort of exaggeration, or whether they're just trying to ingratiate themselves with, you know, with you or with or with people on the other side?
Well, you know, that's the first thing any author, any journalist, any investigator, any policeman needs to do, and I have a lot of training in that from all of my years in intelligence work. But when I sat down with Aspiaga in 2007, I knew his record. I had never met him before, but I knew his record. I knew that in the American intelligence agency, CIA, FBI, he was considered to be an absolutely reliable source because everything he had told his debriefers turned out to be true, all of those things that I mentioned earlier. And so when I met with him, I knew his bona fides, if you will. I mean, that's a term that is used commonly in intelligence. His bona fides were absolutely pure. When I sat down with him, I asked him over those 15 hours many, many questions to try to verify, to try to check. I felt confident, for example, when I asked him, do you think that Fidel Castro ordered the assassination of John F. Kennedy? Do you think Fidel actually had blood on his hands as a conspirator? And Aspiaga very quickly responded. He said, no, I can't say that. I can't say that. I can only tell you what I learned that morning, 3 hours before the shots were fired. Now, I also explain in one of the chapters of my book, Castro's Secrets, I explain how Aspiaga gave me a manuscript, an unpublished manuscript that he had written, several hundred pages. He had written it soon after he had defected. And in that manuscript, he also tells the same story. So that gave me, as an analyst, that gave me confidence that it was the spectacular Kennedy story was not one that he invented during his years of exile. It's something that he had written soon after he defected.
And finally, Brian, I wonder whether a large element of the surprise of Cuba's sort of success as a spying nation, as a spying superpower, perhaps, is the USA's attitude to it, perhaps a patronizing attitude, looking down at this little country. Do you think that there was a surprise that it was so organized and there was almost sort of an element of guerrilla spying?
Absolutely. You know, I think many of my former colleagues in CIA are probably pretty upset with not very happy with much of the material in my book, because the CIA was taken for a ride for quite a long time. We underestimated, we disregarded, we thought Cuba was just a little country of not great consequence in terms of intelligence anyway, and they were beating us at our own game for quite a long time. So yeah, it's very embarrassing. Since 1998, the American services have done much better. Dozens of Cuban spies, agents have been arrested, have been prosecuted. Quite a few are serving prison sentences. So the game has changed. The balance has shifted since Aspiaga came out. So in a real sense, he is a true American hero. He's the one who got us back into good shape dealing with the excellent abilities of Cuban intelligence.
Okay, we'll leave it right there. Brian Littell, thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. We're going to be back in a moment finding out how one of the most iconic US television shows has gone a little bit Brazilian.
On the 16th and 17th of June, please join us at Midori House, the London headquarters of Monocle, as we break out the bunting for the very first Monocle Country Fair, our unique global take on a gloriously English tradition, complete with market stalls hosted by some of our favourite nations and shopkeepers. We'll have face painting for children, marvellous musical performances, a guest chef in the kitchen, and much more. The Monocle Country Fair will be running from 11 in the morning to 5 in the afternoon on the 16th and 17th of June at Midori House. 1 Dorset Street in the heart of London's Marylebone. For more information, head to monocle.com/countryfair, and that's fair with a Y, of course.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bound, and Steve Bloomfield, where it's Brazilian TV time.
Is it?
It is.
Cool.
Just listen to this.
I will.
One of the US's most famous TV shows, Saturday Night Live, has given birth, or been approximately copied, by Brazilian channel Rede TV. It's not been quite the hit hoped for, however. Earlier, I chatted to Brazilian TV critic Tony Goiás and started by asking him why on earth it goes out on Sunday nights.
Because that was the available prime slot on the TV network. So it's really funny. They air the show with the name in English on a Sunday. It doesn't make a lot of sense. But when you see the backstory, you see why that happened. Brazil has like 5 or 6 national TV networks. Mm-hmm. And Rede TV is the youngest of them all. And they face a lot of problems. They don't have a lot of cash. They don't have big ratings. But they did have one hit TV show on Sunday night. It was a humor show, a comedy called Panic, mm-hmm. which is very much in line with Saturday Night Live, more anarchic.
I wondered about the different channels. I mean, presumably on the larger channel, this would have been a good fit for one of the larger channels. Is there anything like this already on Brazilian TV, something that's sort of anarchic and about politics and pop culture?
There are. Saturday Night Live influenced comedy shows all over the world, including Brazil. So you would see similar shows or similar features on comedy shows on Brazilian television mm-hmm. that you can trace the lineage of Saturday Night Live.
Do you get the feeling that it's going to be the same thing with this show on Rede TV, that we're going to sort of discover some stars?
That's a very good question. We don't know, because the premiere was a disaster. It was an unmitigated disaster.
Was it not funny, or did the feed drop out on the TV station? How disastrous was it?
Some things worked, the others not so much. But it was a ratings disaster. They were expecting something like 10 points in audience and ratings, and they had less than 1.
How do they go about redressing this?
Is that they are retweaking the show. They are trying to make the sketches shorter. Some of them were a bit too long. They're trying to make, and also some of them had a very, not intellectual, but it was a bit higher brow than the usual fare on mm-hmm. Brazilian television for humor.
I wanted to ask you on that point whether the audiences, Brazilian audiences, mass market Brazilian audiences, are sort of well educated enough to watch a show that mixes politics and pop culture. Presumably, obviously, there's a growing middle class. Is that borne out in Brazilian TV culture?
It is. It actually, we do have a show. It's an Argentinian format. It's called CQC, Custo que Custar, which roughly translates to whatever it takes. It's very political, very sarcastic, and some of it is very highbrow. And it's a rating success. It's not a massive success, but it found its niche. So there is an audience for that. There is a better educated audience for that for months.
And finally, Tony, how do you think that the show can turn around its ratings? Does it need some sharper writing? Is that the future?
That's a very good question, because if you see the kind of sketch they did, was very similar to the ones they do in America. Very similar, in the same vein. So they will probably have to Brazilianize more the humor. There was one sketch that was a big hit. It was a parody of an interview a famous TV presenter gave 1 week ago. Xuxa, a female presenter, she went on TV and told the audience that she was molested as a child by her stepfather and an uncle and so on. And they made a parody of that. on Saturday Night Live, and it worked very well. So they will probably go, instead of more generic sketches, they will do parodies of what's going on TV at that moment, which is something that Saturday Night Live already does. But they will probably be more topic, more specific.
And that was Rob speaking to the TV critic Tony Goez. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Hongkongist, Tokyos. Sie sind Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Вы слушаете Monocle 24.
Lontosta käsin, tämä on Monaco 24.
London Bo, as a Monaco 24.
Londonan, burası Monaco 24.
Londonist, sinä Monaco 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monaco 24.
O que ninguém atira no ar, Monaco 24.
Αυτό είναι το Monaco 24.
Vous écoutez Monaco 24.
Das ist Monaco 24.
Du lyssnar på Monaco 24.
Kuuntelet Monaco 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24-tagare, ja.
With our new soft porn promo. I like the chap at the beginning of that. This is Monocle 24 from London. This is Monocle 24. Who is that?
I'm not sure who that is.
I don't know.
We should, yeah, because everyone
else might be a Beastie
sort of
Boy.
Works here in Midori House.
Yeah. I don't know.
And I need to listen to it again because I'm fairly sure someone said excruciating.
The excruciating Monocle 24. I think that was Nelly. I think it was
really?
Nelly's voice, Bulgarian.
I think it means something.
Yes, I think.
If you're in Bulgaria,
I like that.
I think that's
dope. That's dope, that promo. I think we can safely describe. We can use
dope.
That word. Dope.
Really?
Yeah.
What are you doing with your hands when you say that?
I'm doing that. I'm down with it. It's sick.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Should we move on?
Should we have some more music?
Yeah, let's.
Midori House, the show that goes out at 6 o'clock every weekday, London time, on Monocle 24, had special musical guests earlier this week when Belarus, band from London, took over our canteen for their performance.
Was it a Midori House session?
Exactly. Belarus has just released their fourth album, and they've been receiving a lot of attention with their new sound. In the middle of their tour, they popped to Midori House, and Monocle's producer, Marcus Hippie, got both Catherine DeBoer and Ricky Fabulous.
Gotta love that name.
Yeah. It's amazing, isn't it?
It's
amazing
the fact
surname
that it's Ricky
to have.
First.
Ricky Fabulous. I know. The amazing Ricky Fabulous.
Jeff Brilliant.
Yeah, I know. Jeff Brilliant. I know it's a bit like, it sounds like a bit of a sort of, if you were going to rip off a Martin Namath novel, it's kind of what you call like Clint Smoker or something. anyway, Marcus chatted to Catherine DeBoer and Ricky Fabulous in the studio, and he started asking them about the story of how Belarus began.
Well, Tim and Ricky, DJ Morris, that is, who's absent today, unfortunately, have known each other since college. And they would... Tim's a record collector, avid record collector and turntablist. So I've heard of these stories of both DJ Morris and Ricky Fabulous making awful noises and very, very long sets. Sorry. very, very long songs and very long sets in, you know, the back bars of places. And they had a lot of fun with it and, you know, chopped up sounds. And then when I came along, we started making songs simply because that jam, which I did partake in the 12-minute songs, you know, we did go there. But when we started being offered proper shows... After this residency that we were doing, we thought we'd better write some songs. And we were putting it and the music out on the medium of vinyl, on 7-inch vinyl, and you can't put 5 minutes on a 7-inch vinyl. So we kind of went to the punk ethic of putting, you know, condensing those song ideas or taking out the good ones and then putting that onto the wax under 3 minutes.
And you were selling those singles yourselves?
Yeah, we walked around... We would post them to places. I think we posted some to Australia, and I walked around Berlin one day and tried to get rid of some of them there. That was quite nice. And in London as well, we were our own distribution, printing, mastering everything. We did it all ourselves.
Initially, you'll be given like three records to a shop at a time, and it's a sale or return. So, you know, if they
still
don't sell
those receipts,
yeah, if they don't sell all three, then you know they'll give it back to you, and you get and. But there was this one shop in London called If Music, and I gave it to the guy, the assistant who works there, and he said, "Well, phone back a bit later, and you know, and find out if you want it, you know, if the manager actually wants any records." And I was staying on someone's sofa at the time, and things were a bit
rock and roll.
Yeah, things were a bit not great. And I phoned the shop back, and this guy started yelling down the phone, going, "I love it, I love it. You must bring 100, 150, 200. Bring them now, now, now." And
we'd only printed 500.
Yeah, like... so that was half of them gone. And it was quite cool that when I took them all down there and I got rid of 200, I was like, I met the guy who runs the record label we're on now there. And he said, "Oh, well, so you run your own record label." And I was like, yeah. And
for I knew 2 days.
Yeah. Well, that was it. And I'd already sold like half the stock. And he said, "Well, how do you find running your own record label?" I was like, "This is pretty easy if you ask me."
I think that's a really good idea for other musicians starting their careers as well. Well, you've gone quite far from those days, actually. You got attention for basically giving one of your songs to be played in a Mercedes ad. Yeah. What did you think about that? Because so many people could consider that as selling out, so to say.
Well, I'd say to them, you be a musician and try and make ends meet.
Yeah, it's kind of basically enabled us to make this album. It paid for a studio, it paid for us to live. I think you could call it selling out, but you have to make ends meet, you know.
Yeah, if you want to make music, you know, it's really, really tough, especially for small bands. And we've been at this for about 5 years. And it was such a welcome thing for someone to say, "We like your music, here's some money, and live off that." That's amazing. But I used to think it was selling out, but it's kind of so, it doesn't actually matter anymore.
Do you think it's kind of a part of the future of music, you know?
Like
in the old good days, that didn't really happen very often. Then all of a sudden, Moby basically gave all the songs from one of his albums.
People don't buy music. People don't buy music, so we have to tour. And if people don't buy music, then, you know, if someone wants to give us some money, we're going to take it to enable us to make more music.
I think my thoughts on that.
It's just a changing environment.
It's kind of like, I think if you write a song and then someone wants to use it in an advert, I think that's fine because, you know, they profit, you profit. That's all cool. What I'm not so cool with is people who write songs with the intention, let's get this synced, let's get this in an advert, because it's like, that's not the reason I started making music when I was like 12, you know, because I thought, I want to get something on an advert. Like, that's not the reason I started making music, and that's not the reason I'm making music. But certainly if someone wants to give me a bundle of cash to use it on an advert, cool.
You're in the middle of your tour, actually. You're going traveling to Europe quite soon. I also heard you are trying to avoid flying.
From the beginning of our touring career, we tried not to use aeroplanes very much, for the carbon expenditure is enormous whenever you take short haul flights. It's not actually that necessary to take an aeroplane, you know, to Paris. It's so much more comfortable going by the Eurostar. And also, you know, as soon as you get out of England, because the trains in England aren't all that comfortable, we know this. But as soon as you get out into Europe, the trains are so comfortable. In Germany, you have draft beer and chocolate cake on the train in the buffet car. You know, this is very good. In Switzerland, never late. That's absolutely wonderful. So yeah, it's for environmental reasons, we prefer to travel by train.
Have you done boats as well?
We have done to Belle-Île, haven't we?
Oh yeah, to Belle-Île, but also we got from Slovakia to Vienna by boat.
Yeah, it's often assumed that if you're a touring musician, you will tour crazy, kind of, you know, get up at 6 a.m. and then fly out to Amsterdam via Rome, and it's just all silly. So we have a great team working with us to organise tours sensibly so that we can have a quality of life while we're doing it and not expend, you know, more carbon that's necessary.
After having travelled so many countries, how are the audiences different?
Well, you never really know, because even in the same country, you know, from north of France to the south of France, people are so different, and their reactions when they're in a group together, you know, crowds are very different. The Strasbourgians are quite reserved, but very, very patient, and they will wait, and very polite, and they'll wait right to the end of the song to applaud, and they'll applaud furiously. And then in Marseille, you know, they'll just start doing whatever they want throughout the show, but, you know, jumping off the sideboards and having a great old time. And this is the same music, so it just evokes different things in different people. And Germany, we've just done a comprehensive tour over there, and it was just so nice to have such a warm response.
Yeah.
So a lot of people have this, you know, response that they feel as though it's a little bit cool or standoffish, but I didn't find that at all. It was lovely, really nice people.
It's been great to have you here visiting Midori House, and indeed you are going back to Europe. You can be seen in places such as Amsterdam and Brussels.
Yes, and soon. Paris, yeah. And we're going...
Festivals have got like Antibes and Saint-Gallen, Morehouse.
We've got some UK festivals as well coming up in, what is it, Soulfest and Shambhala. Playground Festival, Shambhala. Oh, it's quite. We're going to be busy. And the Sandway Festival in Croatia, which we're very much looking forward to.
Thank you very much and good luck with all the travel.
Thank you.
And that was Catherine DeBoer and Ricky Fabulous from Belarus speaking to Monocle's producer, Marcus Hippie. And that's all for this edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show is produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Tom Hall, and the sound manager was Toby Hammond. Don't know why that's so. Toady Hammond.
You meant to say Toby, didn't you?
Boop, boop. Who wants a canary yellow caravan when you can have a motor car? Name that. Name that children's novel. We finish with a song from Belarus's Midori House performance, and this song is called Under Fire. But before we hear it... thanks for today, Steve.
That's quite right. Thanks for today, Rob.
I feel that was the way we sort of said that was as if we were two lovers that had met in a hotel rather than presented a radio show.
Isn't that what we were doing?
Oh, sorry. this is going out on the radio. You know?
It got slightly awkward when Ken came in, didn't it?
I know, and I'd put my trousers on.
Okay, do you want to say goodbye?
Let's say goodbye. We'll be here same time, same place next week. But for now, I'm Robert Bound.
I'm Steve Bloomfield.
Goodbye.
Treat your words with gold. I'ma try to trust you, babe.